phone calls, which he had taped and which were made available years ago from the LBJ Library. We start with a 1964 phone call with Billy Graham.
Hello. Dr. Graham on 9-1.
President.
Hello, Billy. How are you, my friend?
Well, God bless you. I was telling Bill that last night I couldn't sleep, and I got on my knees and prayed for you that the Lord would just give you strength.
I told my sweet wife last night we got mental telepathy. I said if I didn't think I'd embarrass him, I'd say, please, dear Lord, I need you more than every day of my life. I got the Russians on side of me taking Earth. The Chinese are dropping bombs around, contaminating the atmosphere, and I've been tied in here with my cabinet all day, and I'd have him just make him come down and spend Sunday with me.
Well, bless your heart. I'll be glad to. I told Bill that there were two things. One was I just felt terribly impressed to tell you to slow down a little bit. I've been awful worried about the physics.
Well.
And then the second thing, you've got this election, in my opinion, wrapped up, and you've got it wrapped up big.
Hello, this is Michael. This week, I'll be reading for Texas Monthly Archives. Texas Monthly Politics. Unconventional. 1968 was a hell of a year across America. Texas was no exception. By Joe Hawley. Published August 1998. When Henry Keith Sterzing arrived for work at John Foster Dulles High School in Sugarland on the morning of February 28, 1968, he was informed that he had been relieved of his duties. School board members and the district superintendent were seemingly unhappy that during the previous semester, in response to a question from a student about the marriage of U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk's daughter to a black man, the popular young social studies teacher had said that he saw nothing wrong with interracial marriage. It was the beginning of one of the most tumultuous years in modern history, and as Sterzing and everyone else would discover, we were all in for a hell of a ride. Assassinations, riots, burning cities, a revolution. In 1968, we expected the extraordinary, and nearly every day we got it. From France to Czechoslovakia to Texas, those who gripped the reins of power could feel the radiating ripples of change and were desperately trying to hang on. Although, ironically, the Texan in the White House was trying to figure out how best to let go. He was thinking, if I'm not going to run, what can I get out of it that's worthwhile to the country? Recalls George Christian, who was Lyndon Johnson's press secretary at the time. He thought that maybe he could jolt Ho Chi Minh into doing something about the peace talks. That spring, a 28-year-old philosophy professor at the University of Texas at Austin was administering his own jolt. Either you change everything or you change nothing, Larry Caroline told a peace rally on the steps of the Capitol. The whole bloody thing has to go. Although Caroline, the faculty sponsor of UT's chapter of Students for a Democratic Society, later insisted that he wasn't advocating violence, his remarks incensed Frank Irwin Jr., the powerful chair of the Board of Regents. I am absolutely outraged that any teaching employee of the university would do such a thing, Irwin told the Houston Post, and I'm going to do something about it. He didn't have to. Caroline's colleagues voted to remove him from his job after a year. The powers that be were skittish elsewhere, too. In Brownwood, officials of Howard Payne College announced they would not allow hippies to enroll. Nor, they added, may students use drugs, alcohol, or participate in any movement that would directly or indirectly embarrass the president or the Congress of the United States. Early in 1968, John Connally, who was tired of being governor, declined to seek a fourth term, so a real political campaign began to heat up. The GOP chose its most viable candidate in years, Wichita Falls oil and gas lawyer Paul Eggers, while Lieutenant Governor Preston Smith, a colorless conservative from Lubbock, defeated nine fellow Democrats. Among them was Dallas businessman Eugene Locke, whose incessant radio jingle, Eugene Locke, should be Governor of Texas. The Governor of Texas should be Eugene Locke. So insinuated itself into our minds that it took Texans years to erase it. Yet even if Connally was a lame duck in 1968, he was determined to wield his influence over the Texas delegation to the Democratic National Convention. His tool was the unit rule, which required that the votes of the state's delegates be cast as a single block. Labor liberals were just as determined to thwart him. How determined? A fistfight erupted at the state Democratic Convention. Wichita Falls elected its first black city councilman in 1968, Austin its first black school board member. But in Texas, as elsewhere, racial strife was the norm. On April 4th, when Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, student leaders at Prairie View A&M University asked school officials to postpone a dance. They refused, provoking a near riot by 400 people. 3 months later, Robert Kennedy was murdered. And as the summer wore on, anti-war protesters marched and carried placards. In August, one of those protesters, Lee Otis Johnson, a young black field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was found guilty of selling a marijuana cigarette to an undercover police officer in Houston. An all-white jury sentenced Johnson to 30 years for the crime. Appearing in Houston 2 years later, Governor Preston Smith was met by a crowd chanting, "Free Lee Otis." "What's all this about beans?" he asked a reporter, thinking he had heard frijoles. Also in August, Texas Democrats were still squabbling when they headed to Chicago for the national convention. Liberals, who supported Eugene McCarthy, the peace candidate, organized a protest delegation, hoping to unseat the Connallycrats. The convention tossed out the unit rule, but the Texas delegation stayed with Vice President Hubert Humphrey. There was talk of a movement to draft Johnson, and Johnson himself had Connally and his appointment secretary, Marvin Watson, canvass Southern governors. Word came back to stay away. "I think the president was sorely tempted to go to Chicago," Christian says. "Some of us were concerned that he'd go up there in a helicopter and land in the middle of a riot." 30-year-old Ben Barnes, who had been chosen 3 years earlier as the youngest House Speaker in Texas history, had bought a new blue suit at the Reynolds Penland Men's Store in Austin to wear on the first day of the Chicago convention. As he struggled to make his way into the lobby of the Hilton Hotel through a crowd of yelling, milling yippies, someone reached out and grabbed his delegate credentials, tearing off the breast pocket of his jacket. Barnes says he felt closer to Humphrey than most Texans did. "I loved Hubert," he says. "I just think how the course of history might have been changed if Hubert had been elected." His own history, too. Barnes says he could have seen himself in a cabinet position in a Humphrey administration. "What position?" "I could have been president. I mean, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. Maybe Energy." Barnes went on to be elected lieutenant governor in 1968. He is now an Austin lobbyist. And what of the other players from 1968? Christian is an Austin political consultant. Smith, who was elected governor that year, is back in Lubbock. At age 86, he is a fundraiser for Texas Tech University. Lee Otis Johnson appealed his sentence and got out of prison after 4 years. He is rumored to be living in Houston. Sugarland teacher Henry Keith Sterzing also appealed and won. The State Board of Education ruled that he shouldn't have been fired, as did the courts. After working for the federal government and living all over the world, he and his wife now live in Austin, where he is again teaching social studies. Larry Caroline left Austin in 1970, moved to Buffalo, New York with his wife, and never taught philosophy again. "I was frozen out of the field," he says. Unemployed for 3 years, he became a follower of the Lubavitcher movement of Judaism and later ran a day school in Philadelphia. He is now a fundraising consultant. Connally died in 1993 at age 76. Frank Irwin died in 1980. And as for Johnson, the Texan in the White House in 1968 died of a massive heart attack on January 22nd, 1973, 2 days after his second full term would have ended.
By 8 o'clock on the night of August 4th, 1964, the president had his hands full. In just 2 hours, the U.S. would launch a major attack on North Vietnam and escalate the war. The FBI was pushing to make an announcement that it had found the bodies of the three missing civil rights workers in Mississippi. Events were moving faster than the president could control.
You gonna make an announcement?
Within 10 minutes, sir, if it's all right with you.
All right, how are you gonna make it?
Where? From there?
I plan to make it from Washington here, sir.
This indicates the FBI has found three bodies, but not identified them.
Okay, if you can hold it about 15 minutes, I think we'll notify these families.
At 8:35, another call. This time, a better call.
Darling. Yes, beloved.
Did you want me?
I just wanted to see you whenever you were all alone. Just merely to tell you I loved you, that's all.
Well, I'll be over there. The rest are still there?
No, they left at 3:30 this afternoon, dear.
Why didn't they tell me you're back?
Because I guess I figured you just didn't have a moment.
Not any other news?
Nothing in comparison to yours, darling.
I'll try and get some to go water and I'll come over just as soon as I get through.
But honey,
yeah.
Bring anybody who's a bachelor or who wants to eat or who would otherwise be doing without supper until real late with you, will you?
Okay.
Bye.
A 40-second break, then back to business. LBJ was worried and on the phone with Bob McNamara again.
What do you think about it? I don't see why we bring Goldwater in on this. Why don't we just say I thought it appropriate just to communicate my decision to the Republican candidate president? Not say he's assured me of his full support. I think it makes us sound like we're very much together and buddies and agreeing on bombing everybody.
Within an hour, Goldwater was found.
Yellow.
Hello.
Barry. Yeah. I'm going to make a statement in a little bit, and I wanted to talk to you before I did. As President Commander-in-Chief, it's my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against U.S. ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
Texas Monthly Politics. Remembering LBJ. They don't make them like Lyndon Johnson anymore. By William Westmoreland, Mary Roberts Hardesty, Peter Benchley, David Halberston, Tom Johnson, Robert Allen, Bob Hardesty, Joe France, Bill Moyers, and Ralph and Opal Yarborough. Published January 1976. Lyndon Johnson was a great original, a man whose energy and personality knew few bounds, the polar opposite both of Richard Nixon's rootless ambition and Gerald Ford's Midwestern blandness. Only he had the presidential perspective on his controversial years, but his own memoir, The Vantage Point, sets down everything except the man himself. What was LBJ like? A few of his colleagues, aides, and rivals try to give us some idea. The remarks from Joe France, Robert Allen, and Peter Benchley are from the oral history collection of the LBJ Library. General Westmoreland adopted his anecdote for us from his upcoming book, A Soldier Reports. Bill Moyers, Tom Johnson, Ralph and Opal Yarborough, and Bob and Mary Hardesty gave us their recollections directly. They have never appeared before. Cleaning his plate. Not long after my return from Saigon, President Johnson told my wife, Kitsy, that he understood that Quarters 1, the Chief of Staff's residence at Fort Myer, has a spectacular view of the federal city. When, he asked, was Kitsy going to invite him to a little family dinner? Kitsy could hardly believe the president was serious. In any event, what did he mean by a little family dinner? She procrastinated until, in another meeting some weeks later, the president repeated the question with obvious determination to have his way. Kitsy finally concluded that a little family dinner might be construed to mean the President and Mrs. Johnson, their daughter Linda, Lucy was away, and because of the President's high regard for Bus Wheeler, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Mrs. Wheeler. She invited them for the evening of October 8, 1968. Delayed by business at the White House, the President was over an hour late, leaving Kitsy with considerable concern over how her dinner would fare. Yet all turned out well. The view from Quarters 1 was much as the President had pictured it, and the dinner proved a success, especially when it came to a dessert that was apparently a presidential favorite, rum pie. The President, having finished his pie, noted that General Wheeler had eaten only a few bites of his. "Buzz," the President whispered, getting the chairman's attention. He pronounced the nickname Buzz, as if it had to do with a bumblebee, and used a tone of voice that seemed about to introduce some monumental business of state. "Yes, Mr. President," General Wheeler responded. "Are you through with your pie?" the President asked. "Yes, Mr. President." "May I have it?" "Yes, Mr. President." Whereupon, the President, under the eagle-like gaze of Mrs. Johnson, ate what remained of General Wheeler's pie. General William Westmoreland. Leaving on a jet. I particularly remember a visit to the LBJ Ranch in 1968 when all six Hardesties, one speechwriter father, one nervous wife mother, and four enthusiastically impressed children were being given the famous treatment by their famous host. The President himself was undecided about his plans for the following day. We were definitely programmed to return to Washington, but the problem was a tentatively scheduled stop on the way in Cincinnati, Ohio, for the President to address the National Governors Conference being held there. Johnson called his unpredictability keeping my options open, and on this occasion he used that excuse to probe his friends and aides at dinner for reasons to go or not to go to Ohio. The next morning, my husband and another speechwriter wrote a tentative address to the governors, while yet another aide tried to explain the uncertain situation to some agitated people in charge of scheduling the conference. The Secret Service, seasoned by years of sudden and traumatic Johnson departures, and fortified with the knowledge that when the President boards his airplane, it takes off, told us to pack our bags before breakfast. After lunch, most of us were sitting around the swimming pool area in the front yard, relaxed, talking in low voices, suspended in the still, clear Texas summer, waiting for the decision from above about when we would go. All at once, the door of Johnson's bedroom, which was situated in a wing of the main ranch house, opened. Down a walk, leading from his bedroom door to the pool, came the President, wrapped in a bathrobe from which he emerged in trunks, ready for a swim. Johnson swam around a while. He really paddled more than exercised, going occasionally to the side of the pool where he would converse with one of his aides or talk on the telephone with someone in Washington about national and international problems, or with equal concentration to someone in nearby Fredericksburg about buying cattle, but not about the trip to anyone. The rest of us began to relax, as Johnson was doing in the pool. We, the audience, pretty much realized that since Johnson wasn't even dressed, there just wasn't going to be time to leave immediately, as would be necessary, in order to make dinner in Cincinnati. We began to think about how to spend our last leisurely day in the Texas sun before our return to Washington that evening. Finally, casually, the President strolled up the steps of the pool, put his robe back on, glanced around, and started off. Instead of going back up the walkway to his bedroom, Johnson took another path, which went across the front of the ranch house. We figured he was going to his ranch office, which occupied the wing opposite the bedrooms, After all, he was in his bathing suit and bathrobe. He had to enter the house somewhere to eventually change clothes. If that happened, it might mean we were going to Ohio after all. And with so little notice, there would be some scrambling to be ready to leave when he was. But Johnson continued past the front door, past the last side door, rounded the corner of the house, and headed out towards the runway where his small jet sat, the one used to transport him to and from Bergstrom Air Force Base, where Air Force One waited, ready to jet out on notice. Like figures in a freeze tag game, we grew absolutely still as the last glimpse of the disappearing president told us, like a revelation, that a decision had been made. He was going to Cincinnati in his bathrobe. He was going to Cincinnati in his bathrobe? A startled Harry Middleton asked a Secret Service agent. My God, is he going to the governor's conference in his bathrobe? The agent replied under his breath, he's got clothes on the plane. We activated like bombshells. People ran in all directions, to cars, which tore around to the guest homes, collecting suitcases and stray children. Inside, gathering up the Johnson travel gear. Outside, preparing the airplane for takeoff. Within 10 minutes, we were all, Secret Service agents, guests, aides, and families, airborne and breathless, trying to follow Mrs. Johnson's standing advice. Just look on it all as one great adventure. We were on our way with President Johnson to Ohio, and who knew what might happen there? Mary Roberts Hardesty. The treatment. It was my first understanding of the Johnson treatment. I walked in with Mr. Kentner, and the president was at the time finishing an interview with an Indian. I don't know what position in the diplomatic corps of India he held. He was a very slight, short man. And as we stood in the door to the president's small office, off the Oval Office, LBJ was exhorting this Indian about Vietnam and towering above him, waving a hand at him. He gave him that story which he subsequently used, I hadn't heard it before then, in which he would say with grand gestures that all he wanted was if Uncle Ho Chi would take off his gun belt and put the hand grenades away, well then, I'll put down my guns. But if he doesn't, and I put down my guns, you know what? He's going to shoot me right in the rear end. This Indian was nodding politely, awed. He was about 5'1" and looking up at 6'4" of Lyndon Johnson. He was quite terrified. Peter Benchley, former LBJ speechwriter and author of Jaws. The personal touch. He went to great pains to show that he was deeply involved in the inner decisions of the administration, that he was the real insider. One day in early 1961, Russell Baker, then a Hill reporter for the New York Times, who knew Johnson well, had been coming out of the Senate when he was literally grabbed by Johnson. You! I've been looking for you! And pulled into his office. Baker then listened to an hour and a half harangue about Washington, about how busy Lyndon Johnson was, how well things were going. There were these rumors going around that he wasn't on the inside. Well, Jackie had said to him just the other night at dinner, as she put her hand on his, Lyndon, you won't desert us, will you? They wanted him. It was pure Johnson, rich and larger than life, made more wonderful by the fact that if Baker did not believe it all, at least for the moment, Johnson did. And in the middle of it, after some 40 minutes, Baker noticed Johnson scribble something on a piece of paper. Then he pushed a buzzer. A secretary came in, took the paper, disappeared, and returned a few minutes later, handing the paper back to Johnson. He looked at it and crumpled it. Then the harangue continued for another 50 minutes. Finally, exhausted by this performance, Baker left and on the way, he passed a friend named David Barnett, also a journalist. They nodded and went their separate ways. And the next day, when Barnett ran into Baker, he asked whether Baker knew what Johnson had written on that slip of paper. No, Baker admitted, he did not know. "Who is this I'm talking to?" said Barnett. David Halberstam from The Best and the Brightest. From the Heart. One day in the Oval Office, President Johnson was going over possible nominees for a vacated Supreme Court seat. Each of the men on the final list had his champion, and strong arguments were made in favor of several candidates, one of whom was Thurgood Marshall. I was taking notes in the meeting, and it was clear that strong arguments were being made on behalf of one or two other men than for Marshall. After everyone had filed out and I was preparing to leave, the president looked up at me and said, "Tom, I'm going with Thurgood Marshall." I was surprised and asked him why. "Well, Tom," he said, "you're from Georgia. You know what it's like there. But now those poor downtrodden black children will be able to look and see a black man on the Supreme Court of the United States, and they'll know, too, that they can make it." That comment came out of his gut, came out of his heart. He had heard all the presentations with his head, but the decision came from his heart. Tom Johnson, former LBJ press secretary. Oh, my aching shins. Hubert Humphrey told me how Johnson gave him pep talks, and Humphrey demonstrated, saying, "He'd grab me by the lapels." To demonstrate, Humphrey grabbed me and say, "Now, Hubert, I want you to do this and that and get going." And with that, he would kick me in the shins, hard. Then Humphrey added, "Look," pulling up his trouser leg. Sure enough, he had some scars there. He had a couple of scars on his shin where Lyndon had kicked him and said, "Get going now." Robert Allen, Washington columnist. Ho, ho, ho. People always said that he did everything for publicity, that he always carried the opinion polls around in his pocket. I don't want to dispute that, but I do know that many of the best things he did were deliberately without publicity. He had a ranch down in Mexico, for example, and every time he would go down, he would take in birth control pills and nutritional supplements for the villagers. He was always after the president of Mexico to open up a school there, to bring in nurses, to improve the place. There was just this tenderness to him, particularly with children. After he had left the presidency, he had a whole plane load full of toys flown to the Hill Country from Marks & Company in New York. I'll never forget that picture of him, the former president of the United States, dressed up as Santa Claus and handing out toys. He didn't want that to be in the papers either. He did it because that's just what he felt. I guess that's the same reason he went, when he was in poor health and near his own death, to the funeral of some children who had been killed in a bus accident. When I asked him why he had gone, since he didn't know any of them personally, he said, "Tom, those were the kind of people who cared about me, and I care about them." Tom Johnson. Back to the Indians. Lyndon Johnson never liked to give a speech that didn't contain a news lead. "It's a waste of my time, it's a waste of the audience's time, and it's a waste of the reporter's time." The problem was, as budget director Charlie Schultz used to tell us speechwriters on a regular basis, news leads, especially if they were announcing new government programs, had a tendency to cost money. Lots of money. So at Schultz's request, we used to send him advance copies of the president's speeches so he could try to head off a news lead that he didn't think the country could afford. But sometimes we would be operating on such a tight deadline that the speech would be delivered before Charlie had a chance to review it. And sometimes the president would start ad-libbing in the middle of a speech and do his own violence to the budget. One day, he called Will Sparks and me into the office and told us to start working on a speech he could use in conjunction with the swearing-in ceremony for Robert LaFont Bennett, whom the president had just appointed Commissioner of Indian Affairs. It was to be a very high-profile occasion. Bennett, the first full-blooded Indian to assume that post in 100 years, was to take the oath of office in the East Room of the White House, an honor usually reserved for new cabinet members. Indian leaders from all over the country were invited. "I want to give Bennett a real send-off," the president told us. "I want everyone in town to know that he has the full blessing and power of the president behind him. We're going to do something for Indians, not just talk about it. Hell, even my hero, Andy Jackson, broke every damn treaty he ever made with the Indians." "Well, we're going to reverse that," he said. "We're going to give the Indians first-class citizenship. Now I want you two to go back to your office and write me a speech worthy of the occasion. Put some compassion into it. Come up with some programs that will help those people out. Call around the government. Tap some brains." 3 drafts later took us to the morning of the swearing-in ceremony. It still wasn't exactly what the president wanted, but he had to go with it. He started off the speech following the text, talking about Robert La Follette Bennett bearing an illustrious name and about his being the right man at the right time for the right job. The Indian leaders responded warmly. Then the president began recounting the ills we had vested on our Indian citizens, having ignored Thomas Jefferson's plea to treat them with the commiseration that history requires. The Indian leaders were getting with it now, nodding to each other and applauding. This was all LBJ needed to start winging it, and the more he winged it, the more enthusiastic his audience became. It was like a perpetual motion machine. His fervor sparked their enthusiasm, and their enthusiasm redoubled his fervor. Still ad-libbing and pacing back and forth, hitting his fist in the palm of his hand for emphasis, he told them why he was swearing in Bennett at the White House. To let the country know some of these facts. Because if the president won't tell the country, we can't do anything about this 90% substandard housing and about incomes of under $2,000 a year. He turned to Bennett and gave him his mandate. Go back to your office and begin work today on the most comprehensive program for the advancement of the Indians that the government of the United States has ever considered. And I want it to be sound, realistic, progressive, adventuresome, and far-sighted. He talked about the need for better housing, better schools, better health programs, and better job opportunities. The audience was going wild. He admonished the cabinet officers and congressional leaders present to give the new commissioner the support he needed, so we can remove the blush of the shame that comes to our cheeks when we look at what we have done to the first Americans in this country. Turning back to Bennett, he ordered him to go over to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and clean out the cobwebs, set up some civil service boards, fire people if necessary. And then, to the immense delight of the Indian leaders, he told Bennett that if he ran into any resistance, go over to the Smithsonian Institute and get a tomahawk. I was standing at the rear of the room. While the audience was cheering and stomping and whistling, Jim Dusenberry of the Council of Economic Advisers rushed over to my side and said, "Holy God, someone run over to the Budget Bureau and get Charlie Schultz. He's giving the country back to the Indians." I've since thought, what a great news lead that remark would have made. Lyndon Johnson would have been proud of it. Bob Hardesty, former LBJ speechwriter. The cure for baldness. George Christian, then LBJ's press secretary, was in the White House one morning talking with LBJ while the president was in his bathroom. Through the mirror above him, the president noticed a thinning spot on Christian's head. "George, you're getting bald," he said. Christian agreed. "It's because you don't comb your hair right. Sit down here and let me show you how to comb it." And with that, the president took out comb and brush, and for some minutes thereafter, very carefully brushed and combed Christian's hair so that it would cover the bald spot. The president seemed quite satisfied with his results and told Christian that this was the way he ought to wear his hair every day. Christian felt that the president's style for Christian, which meant combing it pretty much straightforward, made him look like a freak. And as soon as he was out of LBJ's view, he went back to combing it the regular way, which exposed his bald spot. Dr. Joe France, UT Oral History Project. The tables turn. 6 months after the 1964 election, the honeymoon was over, and the president began to be roundly criticized in the press. Arriving in his bedroom early on those mornings, I would find him fuming and snorting at a story or column lambasting him. When his mood was especially dark, I would try to console him. "You have to take the long view, Mr. President. Don't take it personally. A century from now, no one will remember that piece." He would only glower. One morning, my own honeymoon with the press ended abruptly with a sharp, and of course unfair, attack from a columnist. When I entered the president's bedroom, I was almost apoplectic with indignation. He was propped up in bed reading the story. Looking at me over his glasses, he roared with glee. "Now don't take this personally, Moyers. Remember the long view. 100 years from now, no one will remember." On photographs he later inscribed to me, LBJ wrote, "To Bill, who forgot his own counsel when it was his ox." Bill Moyers. A Texas Evening. On a crisp Sunday morning in Washington in 1966, our unlisted resident's phone rang, and a voice said, "The White House is calling." Mrs. Johnson's voice came on the wire, and she said to Opal, "Ann and Ed Clark are coming in this afternoon for a visit before their return to Australia." He was the U.S. ambassador to Australia, appointed by President Johnson. "And are to be our guests in the White House for several days. We thought it would be fun for a few of their and our Texas friends to come to the White House for dinner tonight. Very informal." Ed Clark had been the most successful American ambassador to Australia in history, and President Johnson wanted to show his appreciation. The Jake Pickles and the Jack Brooks were there. We spent the evening in the family quarters upstairs, and the dinner was served there in the family dining room. After dinner, we gathered in the lovely round sitting room, from which there is a breathtaking view of the monuments, Washington, Lincoln, and Jefferson. The night was crisp, cold, and bathed in moonlight. To enjoy the magnificent view more, we stepped out on the Truman balcony. The president began to yodel to his dogs in the kennels below, to the south of the White House grounds. The dogs answered with full cry, bugling and baying. The president yodeled louder. The dogs bugled and bayed louder, worthy of a Texas coon, wildcat, or fox hunt. The president chuckled and said, "I wonder what those Georgetowners think is going on at the White House tonight." Indeed, the noise was so loud and the night so still that the Georgetowners might have heard the duet loud and clear. Someone in the group said, "Oh, Mr. President, those first families of Virginia who reside in Georgetown must like it, for they think you have transported a Virginia fox hunt, which is so dear to their hearts, to the White House grounds. No doubt they wish they were here with you." It was a Texas night at the White House. Ralph and Opal Yarborough.
By March 9th, conditions in Selma have gone from bad to worse. Governor Wallace has called LBJ to complain about how his state is besieged by protesters and bearded beatniks. LBJ tries to get him to agree on calling out the guard or accepting federal troops to assure a peaceful march from Selma to Montgomery, the king and his forces have proposed.
Governor, the court has acted now, and obviously the longer the march is postponed, the more problem you're going to have, and the more problem I'm going to have, and the more problem the country is going to have. Well, don't you think we ought to act before it gets beyond where we can?
Well, it's not in any such condition as that now.
I thought you felt like it. We ought to have some guard called up.
Well, I've got the guard alerted. And let's see about when the march takes place. We're not worried about the march itself so much. We're going to be able to handle that.
I intend to call on the President of the United States to provide sufficient civil authorities or officers for the safety and welfare of citizens in and along the route of the proposed march.
LBJ is furious, feels he's been double-crossed by Wallace, who's now calling for troops when he'd previously turned down the president's offer to send them. LBJ calls Tennessee Governor Buford Ellington, who's been acting as a go-between for the White House and Wallace.
But you're dealing with a very treacherous guy, and you all just must not even come in quoting him anymore, because he's a no-good son of a bitch. I'm not going to be double-crossed this one.
George Reedy tried to buck up his boss's spirits by appealing to LBJ's instincts as a political battler.
I think it's too late, Sir Lee. I know it's your decision because you're the man that has to bear the brunt. But right now, I think this just gives the country to Goldwater.
That's all right. I don't care. I have a desire to unite people, and the South is against me, and the North's against me, and the Negroes are against me. And press that really have an affection for me.
LBJ is still pushing for progress in the field of civil rights, but the tone is markedly different.
And this damn world's shifting and changing so fast, and I got 38% of these young Negro boys that are out on the streets. They got no school to go to and no job. And by God, I just scared to death what's going to happen June and July. You know, when you were 17, 18, I ran off to California. Didn't think my daddy had any sense from Texas when I was a boy 16. But if you take an old hard-pecked boy that sits around and got no school and got no job and got no work and got no discipline, his daddy's probably on relief and his mama's probably taking morphine.
Yeah.
Well, he ain't got nothing hurt if he gets shot. I mean, he's better off dead than he is where he is.
Texas Monthly Politics. Voting Rights. RITES. 35 years ago this month, with Selma, Alabama erupting in violence over the issue of race, LBJ changed the course of history. By Brian D. Sweeney. Published March 2000. On March 13, 1965, Lyndon Johnson met with George Wallace in the Oval Office. 6 days earlier, in a confrontation that would come to be known as Bloody Sunday, the nation had watched in horror as Alabama state troopers attacked more than 600 black activists who were marching from Selma to Montgomery. Armed only with the desire to vote, the marchers were turned back with nightsticks and tear gas. Wallace, in his first term as Alabama's governor, had designs on national office and hoped to salvage his reputation. Johnson was under pressure to send in federal troops. With protesters outside the White House criticizing his apparent inaction, some carrying signs that read, LBJ, just you wait, see what happens in 68, the president directed Wallace to a soft couch. Nearly a foot shorter than Johnson, he promptly sank into its cushions. The president pulled up a rocking chair and leaned in close. The Johnson treatment had begun. Over the next 3 hours, LBJ pressed Wallace on the issue of race. Careful not to let the governor play the martyr for states' rights, he cajoled and flattered him. When the president asked him why he wouldn't integrate the schools and let black residents register to vote, Wallace said that he didn't have the power. Johnson thundered in response, George, don't you shit me as to who runs Alabama. In the end, Johnson questioned Wallace's place in history. George, you and I shouldn't be thinking about 1965. We should be thinking about 1985. Now, you got a lot of poor people down there in Alabama, a lot of people who need jobs, a lot of people who need a future. You could do a lot for them. Now, in 1985, George, what do you want left behind? Do you want a great big marble monument that says, George Wallace, he built? Or do you want a little piece of scrawny pine lying there along the harsh caliche soil that says, George Wallace, he hated? Shortly after the meeting, Wallace agreed to ask the president to send in federal troops. The governor, who just 2 years before had declared, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, would later say, hell, if I'd stayed in there much longer, he'd have had me coming out for civil rights. On March 15th, Johnson addressed a joint session of Congress to propose what would become the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It was a bill he had always wanted, for reasons political and personal. Its passage would signify that a Southern president, this Southern president, had broken the long-standing traditions that had kept blacks from voting and the South from gaining equal moral and economic status with the rest of the nation. 35 years later, the effects of that landmark legislation can still be felt. In the 2000 presidential race, for instance, Democratic candidates Al Gore and Bill Bradley have made minority issues a centerpiece of their campaigns, embracing everything from affirmative action to the removal of the Confederate flag flying above the South Carolina State House. Republican frontrunner George W. Bush, meanwhile, is pushing the big tent theory that the GOP can prosper only if it appeals to minorities. Indeed, he has appointed blacks and Hispanics to top jobs in his campaign, just as he has tapped them for prominent posts in state government. For all that, and for other advances in race relations, LBJ's leadership was crucial. How did Johnson become the president, as he liked to say, who finished what Lincoln started? Although as a congressman and a senator, he had seemingly grown more and more conservative, withholding support for civil rights bills, he did an about-face in 1957. Maybe it was his yearning to be a national politician who could run for president. Maybe it was his lifelong identification with underdogs. Whatever the case, as the Senate Majority Leader, he shepherded President Dwight D. Eisenhower's civil rights legislation past a group of hostile senators, the first bill of its kind passed since Reconstruction. 4 years later, as John F. Kennedy's vice president, he spoke out even more forcefully on the issue. Yet when JFK sent a sweeping civil rights bill to Congress in June 1963, Johnson was outraged that he was barely consulted. Unhappy in the political shadows, Johnson told one of his aides, "My future is behind me." A tragic November day in Dallas would change all that. Within hours of taking office, Johnson was laying the groundwork for his accidental administration. We got to his home at 9:30 or 10 o'clock that night, so he had only been president for about 9 hours, said Jack Valenti, who was special assistant to LBJ. I spent the night with him, as did aides Cliff Carter and Bill Moyers. We were all grouped in his bedroom, and until 4 in the morning, the three of us sat around his bed. He was in his pajamas, and we watched television as the commentators discussed this alien cowboy who was now the leader of the free world. He said, "The first thing I'm going to do is get that tax cut. Then I'm going to pass Kennedy's civil rights bill, which has been languishing too goddamn long." Then he said, "I'm going to get another bill that's going to make it possible for everybody to vote without being harassed or having to pay money." The germ of the Voting Rights Act was squirming around in his head on the first night that he was president. Johnson moved on Kennedy's civil rights bill, which seemed to have a slim chance of passing. What Kennedy didn't do was put his political capital on the line, says Valenti. Johnson believed that the Kennedy administration didn't seize the moral authority. To legitimize his position as a president for all the people, Johnson marshaled the full force of his office. Advisors told him to wait until after the 1964 election, if ever, to make his push. Johnson refused. He twisted arms, bargained with enemies, and ran roughshod over friends like Richard Russell, the Georgia senator who was most responsible for his rise to power in the Senate. Even the longest filibuster in Senate history, by a block of Southern senators, couldn't prevent passage of the bill. Though most of the voting rights provisions had been gutted, the bill outlawed discrimination in public places and in employment and brought an end to colored restrooms and segregated lunch counters. It was an extraordinary victory, though it was never entirely Johnson's. When Robert F. Kennedy gave an aide a pen that Johnson had used to sign the legislation on July 2, 1964, he inscribed the following words: "Pen used to sign President Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill." The night that the bill became law, with the 1964 presidential election just 4 months away, Johnson realized how his leadership might destroy the Democratic Party in the South. Sitting on his bed among newspapers that chronicled the day's historic event, he told Moyers, "I think we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come." In November, Landslide Lyndon received 61% of the popular vote, more than any other candidate in the 20th century. But despite his victory over Barry Goldwater, it was already clear that LBJ's premonition was coming true. Goldwater, who had opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, carried only six states. One was his home state of Arizona. The other five were Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. As Johnson prepared for his first full term, he focused on problems that would affect the nation by the year 2000. He formed task forces to provide solutions to such problems as funding for education and inadequate health insurance for the elderly. He deliberately stayed away from civil rights, even though he wanted a voting rights bill. "He believed there needed to be a pause in the effort," says Johnson biographer Robert Dalek. He worried that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 would produce violent opposition in the South, though he was wrong on that count. Violence never materialized. Still, in December, he privately instructed Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach to begin looking into legislation that could be introduced when the time was right. "I tried to slow him down," Katzenbach recalls today, "but he wanted his own civil rights bill." With Katzenbach working behind the scenes, LBJ waited for a reason to move forward. Martin Luther King Jr. gave him one. On the day after the presidential election, King told the New York Times that he was ready to organize marches across the South in an effort to secure black Americans the right to vote. In Mississippi, only 6% of eligible blacks were registered. In Alabama, only about 20% were registered, but in Selma, it was fewer than 1%. For that reason, the city would become a focal point. Starting in January, black protesters met with violence at the hands of white police officers, and they were arrested in great numbers. Newspapers tallied the results. Dr. King and 770 others seized. 520 more seized. One state trooper reportedly told a marcher, "Sing one more freedom song and you are under arrest." On the day King was released from jail, an ad written in his voice appeared in the Times. "There are more Negroes in jail with me than there are on the voting rolls." By February, King was urging Johnson to act, but the president moved cautiously. Johnson knew that back-to-back civil rights bills could cause an electoral backlash, not only in the South, but across the rest of the country. And despite calls for federal troops to protect the protesters, he stood firm. Sending soldiers in would cause the Democratic Party to lose every white Southern vote. Johnson argued that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 needed time to work, but he said that Congress would receive a voting rights bill by year's end. That timetable quickly changed. On February 26th, a black protester died after being shot by a state trooper in Selma. March 7th brought Bloody Sunday. And 2 days later, a white minister sympathetic to the civil rights movement was beaten by a white mob. He died the next day. Selma came to a boiling point, and Johnson was criticized for his slow reaction by the same activists he wanted to help. He knew he had to act. With Wallace in line, it was finally time. Johnson was a great believer in timing, says Valenti. After Selma, he seized that moment like a trout going after a fly. In his address to both houses of Congress on March 15th, LBJ said, "What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause, too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice." Appropriating the language of the civil rights movement itself, he added, "And we shall overcome." Congress responded with a standing ovation. The Voting Rights Act passed the Senate on May 26th, the House on July 9th. On August 6th, Johnson signed it into law. In typical fashion, he did so in the same room in which Lincoln had signed the Emancipation Proclamation. So many people wanted a pen commemorating the day that LBJ used different ones for different parts of the letters in his name. And for good reason. The bill was in many ways more important than the Civil Rights Act. It suspended all literacy tests in 7 of the former Confederate states and placed federal examiners in counties where black registration was below a prescribed level. For Johnson, it became the centerpiece of the Great Society, a sign that he could accomplish anything. Even Vietnam seemed, at that point, winnable. The optimism would soon shatter. After the Civil Rights Act was enacted the previous year, Johnson had told civil rights leader Roy Wilkins, "Our troubles are just beginning. I guess you know that." He had feared widespread violence by whites in the South. Though it never happened then, rioting broke out in the black Los Angeles neighborhood of Watts 5 days after Johnson signed the 1965 bill. When it was over, more than 30 people were dead and 600 arrested. Johnson was shocked by it, says Dalek. That was one thing that pained him throughout the administration. He kept saying, "Look at everything I've done for black Americans. Why are they doing this to me?" As riots spread to cities like Detroit and Newark, he wasn't the only one to sense a shift in the content and direction of civil rights. In 1964, only 1/3 of all Americans thought that racial change was coming too fast. 2 years later, 85% did. Yet Johnson ultimately accomplished what he wanted. Morally, the nation is united on much higher ground than anyone ever could have imagined. Economically, integration has been a boon to all Americans. One need only look at cities like Atlanta for proof. Politically, the impact of the Voting Rights Act cannot be overstated. By the end of 1966, only 4 states in the South had fewer than 50% of eligible blacks registered. By 1968, registration averaged 62%. Furthermore, in the 60s, only a few hundred blacks had been elected to public office. Now, about 9,000 hold office, thanks in some part to the creation of safe minority districts that almost guaranteed a black candidate could win election. Most interesting of all, at least as far as the White House is concerned, the electoral power of the South is more certain than ever. Before Johnson, no Southerner had been elected president since before the Civil War. Yet, 3 of the 6 men who succeeded him have Southern roots. "I don't think you could have had another Southern president without the Voting Rights Act," says Katzenbach. "You needed it to legitimize Southern politicians in the North." The 2000 race proves the point. Front runners George W. Bush and Al Gore each hail from former Confederate states. It's a situation that would no doubt make Johnson proud, except for the fact that the candidate from Texas is a Republican.
It's a little difficult to remember the demure and retiring image favored by Lady Bird Johnson, who was a tough, smart businesswoman in her own right. This tape from March 7th, 1964, offers a glimpse of her in the role of political advisor. LBJ had just completed a televised press conference from the White House.
You want to listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till
tonight? Yes, ma'am. I'm with her now.
I thought that you looked strong, firm, and like a reliable guy. Your looks were splendid. The close-ups were much better than the distance ones.
Well, you can't get them as good.
Well, I will say this. There were more close-ups than there were distance ones. During the statement, you were a little breathless, and there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. Not enough change of pace. Drop in voice at the end of sentence. There was a considerable pickup in drama and interest when the questioning began. Your voice was noticeably better, and your facial expression was noticeably better. Every now and then you need a good, crisp answer for change of pace, and therefore I was very glad when you answered one man. The answer is no to both of your questions. I think the outstanding things were that the close-ups were excellent. You need to learn, when you're going to have a prepared text, you need to have the opportunity to study it a little bit more and to read it with a little more conviction and interest and change of pace.
Well, the trouble is that they criticize you for taking so much time. They want to use it all for questions. Then the questions don't produce any news. If you don't get news, you catch hell. So my problem was trying to get through before 10 minutes, and I still ran 10 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And I took a third of it for the questions, and I could have taken, if I'd read it like I wanted to, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know what to cut out.
Mm-hmm. I believe if I'd had that choice, I would have said use 13 minutes or 14 for the statement. In general, I'd say it was a good B+.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 58 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the U.K., go grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello, world, and from coast to coast on public and community radio stations, as well as a few college stations, welcome to the Make Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour, as I am going to share some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. Hope you're all doing fantastically. You know, I like to play poker, and if I can open a hand with a pair of kings, I'm a pretty happy guy. So I open today's show with kings, two of them. The first king I draw has a picture of the Kingsmen on the card, led by and with musical arrangements by Ken Darby, the Kingsmen, with tenors Bud Lynn and John Dotson, baritone sung by Rad Robinson, and Darby himself singing bass. Well, they joined the Fibber McGee and Molly radio show in 1940 to sing mostly novelty numbers. And during the war on Fibber McGee and Molly, they sang patriotic songs. They also backed comedian Jerry Colonna in some of his most memorable Disney cartoons based on American folk ballads. I'm sure some of you have seen Casey Jones and Casey at the Bat. And they did that while Darby was choral arranger and musical director at Disney. So, friends, to get things started, let's go to a song directly from a broadcast of Fibber McGee and Molly from February the 20th, 1945, to hear the Kingsmen sing Poor Little Rhode Island, written by the not-so-poor legendary twosome of Julie Stein and Sammy Kahn.
Kingsmen and Poor Little Rhode Island.
Poor little Rhode Island, the smallest of the 48. You've got the prairie moon for which coyotes croon, but I still think that you're great. You're such a teensy weensy poor little Rhode Island that all the Texans yippee. You're still the best part of this land I dearly love. And I'll include Iowa. They've written songs about the South. They've written songs about the North. And I have heard them say there's nothing finer than to be in Carolina in the morning. But how about the night before little Rhode Island? Be careful if your fancy frees. In Providence one day she stole my heart away. I dream of her constantly. Let the sun shine bright on your Okanagan home. Rhode Island's a place for me. Washington has the apples, Oregon has the trees. Florida gets the sunshine, Illinois gets the freeze. Every state has room to spare, all but one. Still, I'd rather be right there than anywhere under the sun. Where? Poor little Rhode Island. Be careful if you're fancy free. In Providence one day she stole my heart away. I dream of her constantly. Let the sun shine bright on your Okanagan home. Rhode Island's a place for me.
Before we leave the Kingsmen, I just want to mention that the group leader, Ken Darby, his biggest claim to fame was probably writing the score for Elvis Presley's first movie, Love Me Tender. And his score included the title song, Love Me Tender, which became Elvis's fourth number one record on the Billboard singles chart.
I said we drew two kings, so let's go back to our poker hand and look at the next king with the picture of the King sisters on the card. Elise, Louise, Donna, and Yvonne King recorded It's the Natural Thing to Do with Horace Hite and his Brigadiers. This is a very early King sisters recording, made during their first weeks with Horace Hite. The sisters' career really